Welcome to another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. I'm Jay Caruso, deputy editor of the Washington Examiner magazine. I'm here with my co-host, future to be published author and filmmaker Ben Howe. Hello, Ben.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm fine. Also, rankateur and news gal Andrea Ruth is here. Hello, Andrea.
Hey. I don't know about rankateur, but yeah.
Yeah, we'll you are. All right. And then, so our guest this week, it was kind of like perfect timing. There were some big Supreme Court decisions that were released today. And plus we've been talking about the social media and Section 230, the CDA and Josh Hawley's lawsuit, and wanted to get someone who actually knows the law because he is a lawyer on the show. And so, Gabriel Maller is here. Gabe, thanks for joining us.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
All right, so before we get into social media, Section 230, all that stuff, two big Supreme Court decisions, one having to do with the census and another having to do with gerrymandering. So, Gabe, if you want to give us just kind of like a brief rundown on what both of those decisions mean and what the court said, that would be great.
Sure. The short version for the partisan gerrymandering cases, these are two cases. One came out of Maryland, was a gerrymander in favor of the Democrats, and one came out of North Carolina, was a gerrymander in favor of the Republicans. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 split decision, held that those cases are not justiciable. In other words, you can't sue for partisan gerrymandering anymore. Essentially because the courts are, in the opinion of the majority, unfit to really resolve that question. Because it's an inherently political question of drawing the maps. So the Supreme Court, by Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, said that the court shouldn't be weighing in on those. The proper venue for fixing that sort of thing are the state legislatures or state constitutional amendments. The second case that came down this morning, which I think animated a great deal of conversation on the internet, was about the census citizenship question. This is the issue of whether or not at all the census can have a citizenship question, which it did for many, many years, but not for the last 50 or so. And a majority there, led by the Chief Justice, said that we need more information. they punted again. This is something the Chief Justice does that frustrates me, but I think a lot of people appreciate his incrementalism. He said, and he does this, by the way, by advancing conservative jurisprudence and then ruling the liberals anyway. It's what he did with the ACA case, right? He narrowed the idea that the Commerce Clause can justify anything. But then he ruled on the tax clause with the liberals. And it was like, okay, well, we didn't see that coming. Same thing this morning. The majority say the census citizenship question is fine. It doesn't violate the Constitution. It doesn't violate the Census Act. It doesn't violate the Administrative Procedures Act. And then he joined the four liberals to say, but you have to explain it better than the way you did. And so they sent it back down. So that's frustrating for the administration. The president has been tweeting about it. He says he's asking his lawyers how long they can delay the census to see that this continues its way through the courts, because Commerce will get, under the decision, Commerce will get a chance to explain itself again. The only issue now is kind of a practical one. At some point, they have to finalize the census questionnaire, because then they got to print it, then they got to send it out, they got to train everybody, and of course, it's all supposed to start in 2020. So there's been some argument about just how long they can delay. Initially, Commerce said that in the ordinary course of things, they needed to know by now, by this week. But petitioners say that's not technically true. Technically, they could also, if they spend more money or change the schedule, for example, if this is not in the ordinary course of things, they could push it till October, which means that we may very well have another Supreme Court decision on the census citizenship question in October or September, in October of this coming fall. So those are the two court cases that came down today, and I'm sure they are contentious. Everyone predictably said, oh, it's the end of the Republic, oh my gosh, partisan gerrymandering. I would just remind people that the Democrats just took over the House. Okay, everyone's, oh, the Republicans have rigged it. Well, Democrats seem to be doing pretty fine with that, and the House regularly switches back and forth, at least for the last 20 years or so.
What was funny was Matt Schlapp saying that he supports impeaching Justice Roberts because of the census decision.
Yeah, I saw that just a little bit ago. I didn't even know what he was talking about at first. I saw somebody else say something about impeachments. Don't you think that sets, like, we should be pretty careful about that sort of thing, don't you think?
Are you asking me?
Yeah. I mean, I understand that there's impeachment, like the ability to do that. It's good that it's there, but we can't allow, with how much impeachment is brought up as just rhetoric these days when it comes to the president, even if people have no intent of actually, nobody's going to follow through on impeachment of the president at this point. It's just part of the rhetoric. It's part of the campaigning, and it's part of all of the baloney news cycles that we have. This has now been brought up more and more ever since Newt brought it up, I feel like, in 2015 primaries. People have been talking more and more about impeaching of Supreme Court justices. Wouldn't it be dangerous if that became as part of the political rhetoric as impeaching a president?
Yeah, I think it would, mainly because we don't typically want judges and Supreme Court justices to be looking over their shoulder depending on who's in power in the House and the Senate. That's one of those things where you don't want them having to weigh, oh my gosh, is the Speaker of the House going to hate me so much they're going to try and impeach me if I rule the way I think that I should. I'm of two minds of this, because I would love if impeachment were a more employable solution for executive branch officials. Because typically when it comes to the executive branch, Congress really, you know, has directed the executive branch departments to behave in certain ways. And when they don't, then Congress should have a remedy that, and Congress hasn't used it. But the judicial branch is something different. The judiciary isn't supposed to be beholden to whoever happens to be the Speaker of the House and the majority leader in the Senate. Not in the same way that executive branch agencies are creations of the legislature. That's something people forget. I mean, everyone talks about co-equal branches, and it's not really the case. The Department of Justice was created by Congress. The Department of Commerce was created by Congress. They're not freestanding executive agencies that were created out of whole cloth or out of the U.S. Constitution itself. And so I would love if there was some way that Congress could exert more control, especially these last, really since back into the Bush administration, Bush 43, Congress has been more and more scared to take action because they just want to be reelected. It's much easier to make noise than it is to actually exercise real oversight of agencies.
They kick it all over to the judiciary so that they don't have to make any tough decisions, but then they can run on the importance of the Supreme Court, who's ultimately going to decide the things that they should have been deciding.
Right. Well, that's why this decision this morning on the partisan gerrymandering was a little bit refreshing to see the courts say, or at least the high court say, hey guys, this is your problem. You guys need to work it out yourselves. The courts aren't going to decide on the congressional districts. And I thought that, just as a shouting out, hey, not everything is amenable to resolution in the courts is an idea that people need to remember. They need to be more mindful of that.
You know, I haven't been, in terms of the citizenship and the census situation, like I have to admit, I have not cared that much about this issue. Even though it seems apocalyptic if I look at Twitter. And I just need to understand, like, why would we not want to know something like people who are non-citizens, how many of them are here? Why would that be a bad thing?
Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing. The issue that arises is the claim, and there are studies about this, and it's a lot of statistics, and you can basically make it say whatever you want. But the idea is, allegedly, that by asking about citizenship, certain respondents won't respond, right? They will omit people in their houses because they're unlawfully present, or they will simply not respond at all. And the theory is that that's such a big problem, you would end up undercounting U.S. citizens, not just illegals, but you would actually end up undercounting citizens in areas with high minority populations. And of course, rolling that down the hill, you end up with political problems because those areas tend to also be Democratic. So that's why the Democrats are really crazy about it. So you kind of, like I said, the fear of an undercount and what you can do to mitigate an undercount is what's animating these lawsuits. And they do that, by the way. This is one of those things that people don't realize. We do the decennial census every 10 years, but there's also called the American Community Survey. And this is something, a different kind of questionnaire it's longer too. That's the Commerce does between decennial censuses. And that one has always had a citizenship question on it. So there are ways to mitigate the problems, the fear that you're going to undercount U.S. citizens if you ask about citizenship. And that's really what Secretary Ross had argued in his memorandum, adding it, saying, okay, I recognize this argument. I recognize that the some of his staffers produced a report that said, hey, we could end up undercounting. And he said there are ways to mitigate that using other records.
And so, Gabe, there's the other thing that somebody I missed the first part of what Ben was asking you, but so if I'm repeating myself, forgive me, but a couple of people have been talking about a section of, and I think you may have said something about this just now, is the section of the Voting Rights Act that actually, in a sense, I don't know if the right word is mandates racial gerrymandering in districts where the majority of the people who live there are minority. That there's something like 125 or 126 districts in the United States that are majority minority, and therefore gerrymandering in that respect is perfectly legal, or some people say required. I don't know if required is the right word or not.
Yeah, you could say required, but let's be clear. We're talking about two different things now. The issue that was resolved today was partisan gerrymandering. The issue you're talking about is racial gerrymandering, or in this case, min-maj districting, which is compelled under parts of the Voting Rights Act for certain places in the United States. The idea behind that judicial doctrine that really arose to that is that by clever districting, you could actually end up shutting out minorities even more than they already are if they're in underprivileged or underserved areas. And so the Voting Rights Act has actually mandated some racial gerrymanders in order to ensure that they have enough voting strength to vote for candidates of their choice. But that's different in a separate question than partisan gerrymandering, where we're drawing lines based on where the Republicans live and where the Democrats live. Now, I recognize, and we have to admit, there is, again, a lot, there's overlap between, you know, when you say, if you gerrymander in favor of Democrats, you're going to see more minority voters in a lot of those districts. And if you gerrymander in favor of the Republicans, you might exclude, for example, African-American voters. So that was actually one of the reasons that the Roberts decision this morning was saying, look, this is kind of unsuitable. We're now looking at the motive here. Are they going after the Democrats, or are they going after African-American voters? And it's hard to sometimes suss that out. I think we're going to continue to see lawsuits over the racial gerrymanders. That's just the nature of the beast. But that, at least, arises under a constitutional provision of the 14th and the 15th Amendments, which specifically said, hey, Congress can enact legislation addressing these issues. That's different than partisan gerrymandering. There's no constitutional amendment. There's no constitutional provision that says Congress can direct, you know, court overview of partisan gerrymanders. So it's a different question there.
I've been around for many SCOTUS days, and every single one seems to, you know, you're giving the reasoned and lawyerly explanation of what these things mean, and they all, I can see lots of points of view about them. However, I'm certain that both sides of the aisle have declared today some type of apocalypse. So if you had to summarize what the general apocalyptic views coming out of these sides are over these issues, what are you seeing?
All right, well, from the left, well, let's start with the left on the partisan gerrymandering. The apocalyptic view of the Democrats right now is that the Republicans will redistrict, will gerrymander every district, take over the House, and never lose control again. Oh, not just the House, but also all of the state houses and the state legislatures, and that the Democrats will never be in control again. Is there any reason to believe that's going to happen? No. The five states recently enacted redistricting commissions, so the independent redistricting commissions, so they're not even, you know, going to be able to gerrymander. Several other places have constitutional amendments about it. I mean, the idea that this is going to instantly transform the United States into a Republican-only country is just, I mean, it's quite
awesome. I mean, basically, we're all living in a giant concentration camp now, is what you're saying. not that that means I'm talking about the Holocaust. We all know the word concentration camp has been around for a long time.
Sorry. And turning to the apocalyptic side on the other side, well, I mean, you got it. You talked about Matt Schlapp. He said that the Chief Justice should be impeached. That's, you know, oh my gosh, the fact that Congress may have to provide a more fulsome explanation of how it came to the citizenship question, that's fine. You know, maybe they'll have a chance to do it. Like I said, we don't really know what the deadline is yet for sure. If they don't do it, hey, you know what? We didn't get one in the last census, so hey, we'll get the next one.
It's kind of funny if you think about it. Like, you know, people who are apocalyptic about it and also understand that this really should be what Congress deals with and not the Supreme Court are basically, they're freaked out because they know Congress isn't going to do anything. Like, they know they're not going to do their job, and they're freaking out because they know that. It's really sad. I mean,
well, that was one of the animating forces behind President Obama's, you know, pen and phone second term. He realized he couldn't get anything else through Congress. He got the ACA, he got Obamacare through, then basically couldn't do any of his other major priorities, which is why during his second term we saw all these executive orders and executive memos, because he knew Congress wouldn't do anything. And then, to top it all off, his Department of Justice actually argued that congressional inaction justifies executive action, which was a huge departure, but something that I got to say, the Trump administration is eyeing as well.
That doesn't surprise me.
Hey, anything goes, especially in election year, and especially where Congress seems so paralyzed. And of course, from my perspective, hey, I love that Congress is paralyzed, because less is more for me. But a lot of people disagree. They would like to see some things passed.
Well, and I think a lot of things that you can sort of predict what the Trump administration will be willing to do based on whether or not the Obama administration did it, because it's like they've given certain pundits exactly what they need to play the what about game, and then that's going to be it. Like, once Trump administration decides to take executive actions that we would have been against under Obama, they can get out of any kind of serious frightening criticism by just pointing to Obama and saying, well, he did it first. So what about that? Where were you then? You know,
new rules, so, Ben.
New rules. By the way, my favorite thing so far this morning was what you quote tweeted. Were you going to talk? Were you going to mention that poll somebody was doing?
Oh, the poll where.
Oh, my God. And they were like, would Trump have nominated Roberts if
he wasn't on the court now, would Trump be on, would Roberts be on Trump's list?
And it was 82% of people said no. And I'm like, yeah, okay, he's the big conservative thinker that like would have come along and been like, guys, I just don't think that that he has the prudent background of conservatism we're looking for here. I'm gonna go with Alito.
Yeah,
that's delusional. I mean, I'm not saying he's had bad Supreme Court picks. I'm just saying he didn't pick them.
No. And Roberts is a member of the Federalist Society, and the Federalist Society was still influential even when Bush was president in helping pick Supreme Court justices. So to say that he wouldn't be on Trump's list.
Yeah.
I said the only thing that might have kicked him off at this point is that he's 63, you know, that he's not in that kind of late 40s, early 50s range that they're looking
but
at.
But doesn't it matter at all to people? Like, to me, it's like, you know, you want somebody that's going to be on the bench that's going to be objective and a constitutionalist, and, you know, conservatives, they want an originalist and so on. But that doesn't mean, like, you can still come to a different decision on an issue and I can still think it's wrong. But that doesn't mean that you're now a bad, like, they act like he's the worst justice in history because of some of his decisions. And I'm not happy with some, especially Obamacare, but that doesn't make him worse than Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and they act like he is.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of that is just the betrayal factor, right? He's supposed to be our guy, and the fact that he's not is a huge betrayal, and therefore he should be punished and called out for it.
Right.
Yeah, the betrayal. I love that.
Right, which is like the whole claim is that we're trying, like, you know, that's what conservatives brag about, really. They're like, hey, I want somebody on there that's going to be making objective decisions, or even if I don't like it, and so on. And then they do, and they're upset because they betrayed an ideology, which was exactly what they were saying they didn't want them to have.
Right, and the other thing is, I think Roberts has ruled in something like 800 cases while he's been on the court, and so if you look at, you know, what he's ruled on, Heller was critical with him, and affirmative action rulings were critical with him,
yeah.
And, you know, so there's so many different decisions that he's ruled upon that you could say, yeah, he's been a great pick. And then if you go back and you even look at, you know, how many times they said, you know, we need more Scalias and Thomases, not Roberts. And then if you look at, I think he like agreed with those two like 90% of the time. I mean, you have these one-offs and now you
but
have.
Do you agree, though, that with the Obamacare one, you know, I know that a lot of people say that he made that decision purely on the optics of the court. It wasn't even about what he thought. It was just his concern about divisions over the perception of the court's evenness, and that he felt like this would be a bad look. I mean, that's what a lot of people, do you believe that, or do you think he actually just really believed what he decided?
I think there's been a lot of talk about this. There's a book out recently that claims that he actually authored the dissent before changing his mind and then authoring the piece that authoring the opinion that eventually upheld Obamacare, and that's why it was delivered in such a manner. And I actually tend to think that's probably true. I think he did switch sides. I think he initially voted 5-4. Kennedy had joined the others opposing Obamacare, saying it wasn't lawful under the Constitution. It wasn't constitutional, and he got cold feet. He got cold feet, I think, because he was what he was reading in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, and then switched. And that's why we saw such a kind of an odd arrangement of decisions in the Obamacare cases and FIB. And I think, I worry actually that we saw the same thing today on the census questionnaire, because if, I don't know if you guys discussed this previously on the show, if you know this, a few weeks ago, the New York Times published a hit piece about the census questionnaire. And it's a sensational story. It's a woman whose father died, and he was a social scientist who did research on districting and on the census. And in his papers was a study from 2015 that showed that drawing maps based on citizenship voting age percentages, which is what we would learn if we included the citizenship question in the census, would harm Democrats and probably cause Latino districts to be smaller or to be fewer of them. So she found these papers in her deceased father's stuff, and then she ran to the lawyers in the case, the ACLU and the New York Times, and they published this thing saying, oh my gosh, look at this. There was a secret study. What if that's what influenced Secretary Ross to create this question? And there was all this talk, and it's still going on to this day on Twitter, where they have, I mean, it is now solidified, calcified conventional wisdom that this anti-Democrat and anti-Hispanic animus motivated the Secretary Ross to make a decision on the census questionnaire. The problem with this conspiracy theory, of course, is there's no evidence that Ross was ever aware of this. It was an unpublished 2015 study. They haven't connected the dots, but what they've done is they've used it to say, oh my God, racist, racist, it's racist. And they repeated this over and over and over. It made the New York Times. I think it might have even been on the front page. And I wonder if Justice Roberts, who has shown vulnerability to that sort of thing in the past, was once again, oh no, maybe we need to pump the brakes on this, and then sided with the liberal four justices in today's decision.
Is this, I wonder at times if this makes an argument for having a chief justice having served for some time as an associate justice first. Because it seems like some of this could just be like how many years was he on the bench before the Obamacare ruling, and he felt the pressure of leadership essentially, and that he was responsible for the optics about the court. Like maybe somebody with 10 more years of experience might have come to a different conclusion.
That's a great observation. Remember, he was originally up for an associate justice position after Justice O'Connor died, and Justice O'Connor retired, and then Justice Rehnquist died suddenly.
Right.
So the chief justice spot became open, and they moved Roberts over into that spot and said, okay, actually, no, we're nominating him for that spot, not the associate justice. If he had been just another associate justice, would he care so much about the, you know, institutional legacy of the Supreme Court and its reputation? I think there's a pretty good argument to be made that no, he wouldn't. If they had moved, for example, Clarence Thomas into the chief justice seat, or switched somebody else there, we may not even be in the position we were in with Obamacare or today's decision.
Yeah, it's interesting even that the Bush administration didn't consider that. I mean, if optics are something that, and I think rightly people consider optics, the optics of appointing the first African-American chief justice would have been a win. I don't know why they wouldn't have just done that.
Oh, but there's so much history there. Like there's so much protocol and history.
Yeah, but screw protocol. I mean, we've just like I think that, you know, I don't like throwing protocol to the wind for no good reason, but I also don't like being held hostage by it. And I feel like sometimes we are when people, well, we've never done that before. Okay, but can we? Well, I mean, yeah, we can. Well, then just do it. Like I don't like the idea of not doing what might be a good idea because you're concerned about the especially because of the way the news cycle works. I mean, these days, if you break protocol or you break some norm or you do something unconventional in any of the branches of government, no matter how enormous it is at this point, it's one of the few things that I can actually thank Trump for. It'll be over in a week. I mean, it'll be brought up.
It won't take long, right?
No, it'll be brought up occasionally, you know, and every once in a while somebody will say something. But other than that, I don't know that it has that much. Everybody just goes to the booth and pulls their all whatever button lever, you know? Like, it doesn't.
All right, tangential.
Sorry.
Yeah, we'll use that to segue into the next topic, which is social media. We talked about this for several weeks, and Josh Hawley's bill and the fight over, you know, the quote unquote liberal tech companies and the people who are accusing them of trying to silence conservatives and blah blah blah, and we hear it every day. And so, what, Gabe, you've talked about this on Twitter. And you have seemed to have a pretty good understanding of it. And so one of the things, I don't want to get into a description of how 230 works. I think a lot of people probably listening probably already kind of know that. But one of the things that I keep seeing, and I don't know, maybe you know where the origin of this is, and from what I understand, from what I've read, there's no truth to it whatsoever. But you see it being pushed on sites like, you know, I've seen it on, I've seen Devin Nunes talk about it, and I've seen it on sites like American Greatness, and some very Trump-friendly kind of outlets talk about Section 230, and they say that these platforms, which would be Facebook and Google and Twitter and such, are supposed to be, it's supposed to be a quote-unquote neutral platform. And I don't think that, is there any truth to that? Is there any language that says that these platforms have to be neutral in their editorial decisions that they make?
None whatsoever. And in fact, people don't often talk about it. I know you just said you didn't want to talk about the way 230 works, but there are actually two operative sections of Section 230. There's the one that we talk about most often, which says that these interactive computer services shall not be treated as the publisher of third-party information. But then there's another section, the one right behind that, that says they also can't be held liable for actions they take to moderate content that is obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable. In other words, the CDA actually expressly encourages them to moderate content, and there's nothing in there about being neutral about it. People kind of overlook that second one because that's not really what they want to sue about. People want to sue for third-party speech, but the actual, you know, CDA was created with the purpose of helping encourage these platforms to actually moderate their content.
And so what do you say to the person that says, well, wait a minute, this came out in 1996, there was no Facebook then, there was no YouTube, there was no Twitter, how did they fall under that umbrella?
Right, yeah. Remember back in the early days of the internet, this story, I don't know if you guys have already discussed it, stop me, but the actual story of how this came about is fascinating. It's because of two court cases, two decisions, one involving AOL and one involving Prodigy. And if you remember way back in the day, those sort of services, AOL, Prodigy, CompuServe was one, and other dial-up services, that's the way most people interacted with the internet. Today we usually think, I think the browser is probably our number one way we interact through the internet now. But back then it was through AOL, and of course all of these places, AOL and CompuServe and Prodigy, had their own walled gardens with their own sites and their own comment sections. I know, remember chat rooms were really a thing. Forums were a big thing back then, and more than they are today. And so the different companies took different strategies. AOL was basically a free-for-all, and a lot of its chat rooms were filthy. And AOL got sued by somebody who objected to third-party content, not AOL content, but somebody else who was using the AOL system. They sued, and a judge said, no, AOL cannot be held liable because that's not AOL's content. They didn't publish it, they didn't create it, so they're not responsible for it. Well, Prodigy billed itself as the family-friendly alternative to AOL. So they did moderate some comments. They would go through and delete objectionable, you know, obscene, lewd stuff. But they could, of course, couldn't moderate everything because that's impossible. And they too got sued. Same situation. A third party user says something, you know, horribly offensive or unlawful, and another person sues. And a judge decided that because Prodigy moderated some content, it's responsible for all of the content, regardless of whether it created it or not. And a representative from California saw this in the newspaper and said, this doesn't make sense. Prodigy is here trying to create a family-friendly environment. They're imperfect at it, but they were trying to do a good thing there. And so that's why the CDA was created, was saying, okay, we want to encourage places like Prodigy to be able to create family-friendly areas without then transforming them, you know, causing them to be liable for the speech of third parties. This fascinates me because it's totally a different way of thinking about the internet. Like I said, now we access the internet primarily through browsers. That's where we see Twitter. That's where we see Facebook. And And as a result, again, you get this weird platform publisher thing that people talk about on Twitter that I would love to know where that came from. And people really seem convinced that it matters whether or not a company moderates content. I don't know if you guys have heard about this. I would love to figure out where that originally came from, or if that's just an evolution of the idea of that original judge in the Prodigy case, right? Because that's kind of what he was saying. Was saying, hey, Prodigy, you moderated some content. The fact that you missed this one, well, sorry, you have to be liable for it now.
Well, I think what's also fascinating to me is that you know, Jay, you and I wrote a Red State, and anybody can sign up for an account and create it, you know, write an article and post it.
Right.
And we moderated the crap out of those things.
And
moderated comments, not only on our own posts, but on the posts of others. At one point, we literally said people who liked Ron Paul weren't allowed to write on the site. So, what I mean, if the dreams of some of the people on the right, some of which may write for Red State, were to come true, why wouldn't the left just be like, oh, cool, we're going to come, you know, diary bomb Red State now? I mean, I think other sites like Breitbart, they don't necessarily have to worry about that because they don't have user-generated content. But a community website like Red State would be totally vulnerable wouldn't they? I mean, wouldn't that fall under if Twitter was being forced, if their hand was forced in this way, wouldn't a community website like Red State have their hand forced?
Well, Red State would probably, if we're talking about Senator Hawley's bill, Red State probably would come under it because it doesn't have enough users. You had to have 30 million American users generate a certain amount of revenue, which I don't think Red State quite manages. But there are, you know, a lot of places that Reddit would immediately be gone. Obviously, Twitter, Facebook, Google, Amazon. I was mulling how Senator Hawley's bill would handle Amazon because, I mean, of necessity, it's sharing content created by other people. I mean, that's its business model. So I was kind of wondering how that would work out.
I mean, I've seen mixed opinions about this in terms of what his objective is here, and mostly what I hear is, oh, he doesn't expect any of this to happen. And this is just to make it look like he's doing something to people who are upset about Twitter and Facebook.
You know, I did see that too, and it's one of these things where it sounds like they're trying to let him off the hook for a bad bill. They're like, okay, look, yes, he opposed this bill. He's not really serious. He's just calling attention to it. He's just creating a conversation. Look, you're a senator. This is your job. So either do it in a forthright manner.
Or he's just being a provocateur. He's the Milo Yiannopoulos of the Congress.
All right.
So, Gabe, let me ask you this, because I was having a discussion with Kurt Schlichter, and Kurt...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Well, Kurt was, you know, Kurt didn't like what I was saying to him. So, of course, he starts saying, well, you're not a lawyer, so you don't know. He's like, well, okay, well, we're going to have a lawyer on tomorrow. So we're going to ask
the lawyer. Say new rules.
Yeah. And so what he's saying, he thinks that he could make the case that, you know, I guess there's in certain states you can't discriminate. A business cannot discriminate based on politics. He cited California as a state specifically that we're just like with race, you cannot discriminate based on politics. And he thinks that he could make a case that conservatives are being discriminated against on social media platforms. How would you go about proving that?
Well, I'm hesitating over that because public accommodation laws, which is really what he's talking about, and employment law is a really bad fit for social media and internet enforcement. Because fundamentally it doesn't address the same sorts of things. We become accustomed to thinking of Twitter as a service, a place that we're entitled to be at, but we're not. It's not a business premise. It's not a location you can go to. Nobody spends any money on Twitter except for people who are purchasing ads or doing political campaigns. You know, most of us just interact with it freely. I mean, we are the Twitter content. We're the goods that are on the shelves of the Twitter store. So it doesn't even map over. I'm really struggling.
That's kind of a fascinating way to put it, if you think about it. Like, there, you know, if the content is what needs to be regulated and we're the content, they're literally asking them to regulate us.
Right. Well, no, that is what they're asking.
They're saying, please do more. And what gets me too is this argument. He can prove that they're discriminating. I mean, I agree that there are certain things that happen that I see happen to conservatives more than liberals on Twitter. But Jay, we were talking about this just last week or the week before. The president is the, you know, the leader of the conservative movement at this point. He's the certainly the leader of the party.
Leader of the Republican Party, sure.
Yeah, and well, I would argue whether or not you like hearing it, he's the right. leader of the conservative movement as well.
Move along.
And and there's explosions behind you while you're saying that. Anyway, what's amusing to me about that is like who wields more power on social media right now in a lot of ways than the right? They won because he was so adept at using it and because he has such a uncanny ability to make the entire platform go insane. And as I've said before, if they really, really wanted to get serious about changing things, Donald Trump could move to whatever platform he wants. Everyone would follow him. I mean, even the people who hate him, they don't want to miss anything. They're all going to go there. And, you know, a lot of the people that I hear the most loudly yelling about how we're being detoothed and conservatives are being detoothed on social media, they're using the platform that they're talking about to tell everyone that. They're getting attention because they do effectively use it. And then a lot of it is also misconception. How many times have you seen people be like, oh, these images are getting blocked? And I'm like, well, have you looked at your privacy settings? Because that's in your privacy settings. You can make it so you can see content that is so-called controversial
right.
if you just go turn that off.
Right. But I
just don't know that you can make the case. I mean, I get like the some of the stuff that people are talking about, like, you know, if you were to assign certain things in the terms of service as being as being progressive in nature, you know, like if transgender issues, if you were to say transgender issues are by definition a left issue and Twitter clearly has created rules that protect that and put any alternate opinion at odds with it, that has to be banned or whatever. Well, if you've assigned it as a left issue, then yes, that's a left bias. I'm just not sure that was really a left issue.
Right. Well, I mean, when you look at Alex Jones, for example, and Andrew and I were talking about this earlier, if you say Alex Jones was banned, well, if you're talking about the discrimination portion, how do you prove he was banned from YouTube or Twitter or whatever it is, or Facebook, all of them, because he was quote unquote a conservative? I mean, how is 9/11 conspiracy theories and Sandy Hook conspiracy theories, how is that left versus right, political versus conservative versus liberal?
I don't see Kurt Schlichter, for instance, calming down his conservative rhetoric. So how do you make the case that there is a bias against conservatism when there's shit tons of them online saying everything they always said? And the only people are banned, not the only, but a lot of the people who are banned are people who those same folks will say, I mean, I don't support them. I don't like Alex Jones. Like, they're identifying them as being something other than. They're saying, well, they're not really conservatives anyway. Well, then what are you talking about? So the problem is they're discriminating against whatever Alex Jones and Milo Yiannopoulos are, because you just said that they aren't conservative.
Right. And Gabe, on the principle of this, tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, based on scale. So if I have a personal blog and I have comments that are open and someone comes along and posts something in the comment section that I find offensive and I decide to remove it, isn't that the same as what Facebook or Twitter is doing, just on a larger scale? I mean, they're not publishing it, and I'm not publishing something. The person who put the comment up there published it. It was his words, and I've chosen to sit there and say, well, I don't want anybody reading this. I'm going to delete it, and then if I have to, I'll ban this guy's IP from him coming back and leaving comments again. I'm not acting as part of a publisher on that situation. It's still a blog. It's still a WordPress situation. There's a web host and everything else. I'm not the publisher. I'm just somebody who has a platform that says, okay, I got these blog posts here. You can leave comments. I don't see how that's any different from Facebook or Twitter.
Right. The important thing here is that you're not a publisher of a third-party content, whether you leave it up or whether you take it down. Either way, it's fine. The same is true of Facebook. The issues here are that your blog is your blog, which means you can control the content on it. Facebook is Facebook's property. They can control the content on it. And they, you know, we would like them to be even-handed about it and not, you know, discriminate against anybody for whatever reason. But when you get down to it, Facebook does belong to Facebook. Twitter does belong to Twitter, just like your blog belongs to you, and you can take down content or put up content as you choose. The idea, and again, this is where we see, I'm sure you've seen it on Twitter, people talk about, well, these are so big now that we have to consider them utilities. They're public utilities. The courts have flatly rejected that. In fact, last week, the Supreme Court came down and said, no, the fact that you have a wide open comments on the internet does not transform you into a public platform, a public service. And I guess one example I might give, I mean, Google's a big one, because Google isn't like Twitter. It's not like Facebook in that its content is, it's scraping the internet. It's using content created by other people, but its service isn't really the same. It's not the same way we use Twitter. They are not responsible for example, third-party advertising that's false and misleading. That's just not their thing. Even if they're made aware of it, by the way, right? If they know that there's some scam ads out there, Google is still not liable for people who become victimized by those ads because of the CDA.
That's
well, I'm also curious, you know, when it comes to the they hauled Zuckerberg and everyone else in front of the Senate, and I feel like the on both sides of the aisle there seems to be the desire to work together with these social media networks. Because there is a common sense responsibility to suppress fake news and the dissemination of fake news. And I keep wondering, like, why? Like, why do they have to do that? Why is it the responsibility? I know what Facebook is, just like I knew what email was before Facebook existed, and that when I got forward this email to five of your friends or somebody's going to die was fake news. But they kept getting passed around anyway. And I think the idea of fake news and propaganda and at various points has come under other forms, even, you know, newsletters or whatever. And I just like when we act like they do have that responsibility and we call on them to do that and haul them in front of Congress and demand that they do that and discuss it with them, we're just opening up to regulation, aren't we? I mean, why not just understand that there's a lot of idiots in this country and they're going to pass fake news around to each other, and it's up to all of us to just try to be discerning.
Right. Well, once you get Congress involved, then it becomes a First Amendment issue. Even if Congress has no intention of ultimately passing legislation, then they shouldn't be calling, you know, Facebook to account for Facebook content. And the same thing with these other, you know, large social media companies. At some point, Congress too, right? All those Congress critters also took an oath to uphold the Constitution. They don't need to be harassing private businesses for private conduct.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong here, because again, I'm uneducated. I'm not a lawyer, but you know, the company, in a sense, I mean, they have free speech, right? If you are infringing on their free speech on behalf of other people's free speech, aren't you still infringing on free speech?
Right. Well, that's the point about Senator Hawley's bill, too. It would probably be struck down as unconstitutional immediately because, as you say, Twitter has a right to Twitter's speech. Twitter has a right to moderate content as it chooses, including for political reasons, just like I do, just like you did on Red State, just like any other private citizen.
Well, so what's Jay, were you got any solutions then? Because, I mean, like, I agree that I do believe that, you know, in the offices of Twitter and the offices of Google and in the offices of Facebook, you are going to get along better with your coworkers if you can't stand how much you miss Barack Obama more than if you wear a Make America Great Again hat to work. So I think there's a liberal culture at these places. And I think that when there's humans involved, there's going to be a tendency for them to see something as more offensive if they disagree with it. And then if they disagree with conservatives more often, they're going to ban them more often. We just leave this to the market, right? Just let people who don't like it or feel they're treated unfairly either leave or complain loudly or appeal what's happening. I mean, like, I'm friends with Bruce Carroll. I'm friends with him. And I stopped and I told him this, so this isn't talking behind his back. Last time he got banned for something, I was like, yeah, I stopped ever joining in on the hashtag free Bruce situation, because you literally try to find out what the terms of services are, and then you go out of your way to defy them. Like you're trying to get banned. And I think that you know, trolls do that as well. And I think people, how many people have you say, like, it's ridiculous that they were banning people for saying learn to code? It was absolutely ridiculous. But then when people know that's the policy, and this is a company that can do what they want, even if it's stupid, and they're saying, if you say learn to code, we're going to ban you. And then somebody goes out of their way to say learn to code in defiance of that, and then they get banned. Are they really a victim?
I love the point you're making, because I was thinking of it earlier when you guys were discussing Milo and some of the other people who've been banned, Alex Jones. And I always think to myself, you know, it's not so much they're being banned because they're conservative or because they're right wing or all right. It could be just because they're a-holes. You know, I mean, that's really, you say, when you talk now about trolls, and I'm not calling Bruce is a friend of mine as well, but saying it, but I mean, it does seem like people sometimes go out of their way to be jerks on the internet, and then they cry foul when Twitter says, okay, well, that's enough. You know, Facebook says no more.
Right. I mean, like, you know, go into the real world. There's rules that I mean, when you're not allowed to bring candy into a movie theater, and they gouge you at the, I mean, I go in there and it's like $6 for a tiny bag of Reese's Pieces. I hate their rule, but I want to watch the movie. So I live with their rule, or I sneak it in or whatever, but I'm not calling Congress to regulate the movie theater so that I can get Reese's Pieces to come into the theater. And I'm certainly not claiming, if I get kicked out, that they're discriminating against people who like Reese's Pieces.
Right. And it's the same thing if I went across the street to the diner near my apartment building and started, walked in there and started screaming at all the customers and yelling at them, and get told to leave, and notice that, you know, there's a liberal guy sitting at the counter. I'd be like, well, wait a minute, you're kicking me out because I'm a conservative. No, he's being quiet and he's eating his breakfast. You're screaming at everyone. That's why you're getting kicked out.
I would say I get more upset when the screaming liberal doesn't get banned than when a screaming conservative does. Like, that's where I see the most bias. It's not when a conservative like Milo gets banned. It's when some of these trolls on the left that have just as much visibility and at times will say things that sound like they're threatening the president of the United States, and they don't get banned. That's when I'm like, yeah, there probably is a treatment, and
I don't doubt that. And we've talked about this, and we don't deny that there's probably some bias there on the part of the companies, because you're right. You do have that. And then you have the situation where they try to do everything via algorithm. And then we saw historical videos about the Nazis getting removed from YouTube as a result. But at the same time, I'm not about to sit there and say I'm going to, you know, the idea that conservatives are saying, yeah, we need the government to come in and save us. And now get ready for this. I may have mentioned this last week, but Gabe will probably be a little bit shocked. I saw Dan Bongino say, you know, here's the start of the tech wars. And I was like, OK, so let me go and watch this. And surprisingly, he came out in opposition to Hawley's bill. And he said the idea that you would hand over power to unelected bureaucrats at the FTC to determine what is politically neutral is just ridiculous. He goes, what's going to happen is these platforms probably will just stop allowing all political points of view.
Which is exactly what we said about radio during the Fairness Doctrine.
During the Fairness Doctrine. He even said, he goes, I hate Twitter. He goes, I don't want to use it. He goes, but I have to.
Yeah.
So he knows he's got a platform on Twitter, and he uses it effectively to get people to listen to his podcast, which has given him 50 gazillion advertisers on his show. Mm-hmm. So
I would say, though, that, you know, a lot of this is I get it. You know what I mean? Like, I'll never forget during the Obama years when they were talking about high speed rail, and it was like going to be going all the way up the East Coast. And it was like, I knew how much money Amtrak loses, and I knew how much of a bad idea this was. I didn't care, though. I wanted a high-speed rail. I mean, I didn't go out there and rally for it or anything, but I have to admit that when it turned out it wasn't going to happen, I was like, oh, damn it, I really wanted to get to D.C. faster. Like, you just want what you want sometimes. And, you know, when you mentioned Google a moment ago, I don't use any other search engine. It's just like walking out the door to me. Like, I'm not going to use a different door. That's where I go to search for things. I want it to just stay that way. And the temptation, if it started to change in some way, to be like, make it stop, is high. You know, And so when it comes to this, the Twitter, the social media issue, it's, we've talked about this before, Jay, you know, you're talking about people who have the democratization of influence and so on. You know, 10 years ago, would they have been able to get into an argument with Jake Tapper? No. And they want us, they want to keep that. That's really all it is. They just want to keep that. They want that the way I wanted high speed rail. They're just going a little farther than I did. I was more like closing my eyes and going, oh no, don't do that. You know, they're going out of their way to try to rationalize how to force it to go the way they want. But I do get the instinct. They just don't want it to change. They liked how it was.
Right. All right. So we got about 10 minutes left here. And so Gabe, Andrea wanted to talk to you about something. She saw you do a thread the other day on college debt, and obviously with Bernie Sanders' plan to cancel all college debt. So, Andrea, go ahead. You wanted to kind of weigh in there.
No, I just want
No. Yes, the answer is
no,
yes.
No, I'm not saying no. I'm saying I'm not like.
You literally said no. That was the word you used.
Gosh, okay. Gabe, you have a knack for doing something that something that I rarely do, and something that a lot of people on Twitter rarely do, which is actually positing questions and dilemmas of arguments that people want to, that we don't actually have answers for. And you had this thing about, you know, when Bernie Sanders came out and several other Democratic candidates want to just pay for college outright. And you had this great thread. I think it was probably 10 to 13 tweets, but it was this great thread about, yes, if you took out student loans and you're paying them back and you are doing this admirable thing, then yes, you know, all of us feel like you are a super, super, you know, special person, that you are doing the things that everyone's expected to do. My own younger sister actually just yesterday tweeted all of us in the family that she paid off in one lump sum her last $88,000 worth of student loan debt. And she had asked each of us, like, what do you think I should do? Should I keep this money for saving towards the house, or should I? And she's single, she's in her mid-30s, and you know, these things. But you had a great thread and got so much pushback, and you and, you know, another, you know, former Ace of Spades guy, Virad Mehta, you guys both kind of go toward really doing what Twitter was started as a way to like kind of posit questions, and yet you get so much pushback when you actually said, hey, if you're actually, you know, took out student loans and are paying them back, that's great for you. You're a special person. I think you're special too, but there are tons of people that aren't in that situation. And so I just kind of wanted to at the same time, like, ask you what, if you, because I don't think you were actually, you know, coming up with answers for anything. You were mostly just asking questions. But at the same time, along with that, wanted to ask you, like, how do you handle social media when you're trying to use it, like, you know, days of yore, and say, oh, I'm going to bring you this, you know, extrapolation over 15, 10, 7 tweets, and but at the same time get a ton of blowback, because I saw that when you were doing that. And so I just kind of wanted to see how you kind of are going about social media these days, and kind of dealing with the whole, you know, free college tuition, free Medicare for all.
Sure. Yeah. I appreciate your comments. The basic answer is that, unlike the old days, for me, I try not to argue with people on Twitter. Getting into arguments at, you know, 240 characters a pop is spectacularly unhelpful. You're changing so very few many people's minds. And so that's why, like you said, I was mostly asking questions, because in that particular context was about student loan debt. It's because a lot of people talk past each other on that question. And I would you know, see that often. Everybody says, well, I'm paying off my loans. I worked really hard. I did the right thing. And I want to, you know, just kind of in a sarcastic way to say, congratulations, you did do the right thing. Good for you. Now let's talk about the people who either can't or won't do the right thing, whether or not there's a problem, whether how large that problem is. Is it a problem warranting federal action? If it's, you know, it could not be. I tend to think we do have a bit of a problem, particularly with people from my generation, millennials, with student loan debt. That's going to, you know, we already see in this generation the delaying things like marriage, home purchase, children. Like, those will have far-reaching consequences, consequences that we may not be aware of yet. But there are a lot of people, particularly from Gen X, a lot of the boomers, who are like, oh, this is ridiculous. What do you mean paying off loans or helping her? I don't know what the right policy solution is, but I just wanted people to say, to realize, hey, we might have a problem here, and we might want to fix it earlier rather than later before we run out of capital, because eventually it becomes a problem that's just, it's insolvable. But anyways, yeah, no, as far as my Twitter usage, I try not to argue with people. You know, I state my position and I move on. Also, and this is sort of unfortunate, I have really extensive notification filtering up. Basically, every single notification filter, except the one that requires me to follow you back, is up. And I only follow very few people on Twitter. What I do have is a Twitter list. It's a Twitter list. I can't remember who made it, but it's of reporters and bloggers, and it's reporters and bloggers from far left to far right. So I do get a very large slice of news content. Mm-hmm. And then as for personal follows, I mean, I mainly follow people that I'm friends with, people that I may want to interact with for reasons of commentary. You know, I write pieces for several different outlets, so I usually have a lot of those guys up there. But as a general matter, I mean, it just... Twitter was making me feel bad because I would get into arguments, and then I'd come back later and be like, well, crap, am I still arguing with this person? Am I not arguing with this person? I thought, you know what? I'm not going to argue with people anymore.
You probably don't remember this, Gabe, but one time I asked you a question, and I was seriously asking, but I think you took it as one of those things where I was kind of like, oh, yeah? Well, what about this? And you just kind of like, you like shot back at me. Well, listen, sweetheart, I know what I'm talking about. And I was like, and I went back. I was like, dude, I was really just asking. I didn't know. Because yeah. I've learned a long time ago, there's one of the things that I think, and you probably know this as a lawyer, when somebody says the law is clear, I kind of laugh, because it's like, I think you could probably, a lawyer could take a two-word law and make it unclear. It'd be very easy for them to do so. So it's one of those things where it's like, I rely on experts, and so just as a personal prop, whenever there's Supreme Court decisions that come out or court decisions, there are two attorneys that I follow on Twitter that I always look to, and it's you and Chris Geidner from BuzzFeed, who I think offer straight up analysis. And it was what Ben was talking about before. You're just basically saying, here's what the court said, and I'm going to break it down for you in kind of more simple language so everybody can understand, rather than going into the political dynamics of it and either complaining or praising the court for what they've done, or because it hasn't done this, or it'll have this kind of ramification in a political sense, rather than just saying, here's what the court said, this is what it means, and here's what possible effects it may have down the road, whether it's negative or positive, it doesn't really matter. So that's always a good thing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, my role as a lawyer and as a legal commentator is to say what happened, not what I think should happen or what they got wrong. Or, you know, I do that sort of commentary too, usually aside from the actual reporting on the decisions themselves, right? The decisions are going to fall or stand based on what the judges or the justices wrote. And then later on, maybe I'll come and comment on it legally. But I first want people to know what they did rather than what I think they should have done.
Did you ever use, in terms of what you were saying about everything you've set up to kind of make your Twitter experience more pleasant, were you ever a TweetDeck user?
I do use TweetDeck. Yeah, no, I have columns. I have a home column, mentions column, the reporters and bloggers column I mentioned before. And that's about it. I have a few.
Yeah, I've been thinking that like the way I have my TweetDeck set up is part of my, because I did what you kind of a version of what you're describing on Facebook, because people always talk about Facebook being a dumpster fire as well. And I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I had resisted setting up a fan page forever because the idea of the word fan being associated with me sounded like narcissism. And I was like, you know what, from this point forward, I'm just, if I have something political to say, I'm going to put it there. And on my Facebook experience, I no longer look at newsfeed. I don't care what anybody else is saying. I'm going there to make it so I can give my pictures of my kids to my sister, my brother, and my mom all at the same time. And, you know, I'll post something funny or whatever, have some interactions in the comments. But my Facebook experience is incredibly pleasant now. There's nothing wrong anymore. There's no fighting. There's no dumpster fire in my comments. There's nothing controversial. It's just pleasant. And I think my problem with TweetDeck is I've set it up to to make it so I see too much. Like, I see enough stuff that it's going to rope me in into the downward spiral of arguing with people. Is that kind of what the conclusion you came to was, that you were seeing too much?
Yeah, not just that I was seeing too much, but the content I was seeing was, forgive me for using the term, triggering. You know, you see something and you're like, oh, I mean, you know, XKCD, I think, has that, you know, wrong on the internet. Somebody's wrong on the internet right now, and I can't stand it. And it wasn't just, you know, once or twice, but I mean, it's just, it's Twitter. It's a rolling torrent of people with opinions on the internet. So I feel like cutting down on that a little bit and curating it more, you know, great thing about Twitter for the most part, except of course when Twitter's, you know, algorithms dropping crap in our timelines, is that we get to pick what we see. And I'm not advocating that people bury their heads in the sand. Like I said, I have a list with far left to far right. But just, you know, be aware. You don't need to be triggered. If something is irritating, mute it. You know, if somebody, I have a really strict muting policy. If somebody has bugged me and mentions, you know, two or three times in a row without me responding to them, they're a nag, and I don't need nags in my life, so I mute them. my mute list is probably thousands and thousands of people long. I think people spend a lot of time yelling at me, and I have no idea that it occurs.
That sounds beautiful. I love the sound of that.
That's what I try and explain to people, too, on Twitter, like proper modes of behavior. You know, we all know how to behave in person. If you're at a dinner party and somebody is talking to you, you can talk back. If somebody's not talking to you, if they're on their way to the bathroom and say, oh, excuse me, please, right? You shut up and you let them go. You don't just stand there yelling at them across the room. But on Twitter, people seem to think that, oh, I can think they can just drop a million mentions at you. So this, that, the other thing. And oh, my gosh, and did you see? And holy, I'm not talking to you back. Did I ever talk back to you? Did I give you any indication at all that I needed to have all of that dropped on me? The answer is no, so you're getting muted.
by the way, just before we wrap up, because this is relevant to what we were talking about, Schlapp, I replied to his tweet earlier, and I said, I hope he sees this, bro. And he, because you know that meme, right?
Yeah.
And he replied to me, me too, Ben. What you up to? Like, he quote tweeted me and everything. And I'm like, what? I don't even know. We can have a snark war if you want, but I just don't even know what. How do you come back to that? He didn't say anything.
I don't know. That's good. I'm gonna
impeach him.
Okay. Well, we got one time for one news item. So, Andrea, you are the news gal. Let's hear. What do you got?
No. Well, first, what
you
I
go with that no for... again. Yes. Yes.
What?
I said we have one news item. What's the news item? You were like, no. And then you proceeded to go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, the only thing
we're not going to interrupt you again. You can go ahead.
Yeah. No, my main thing was that the something that I wanted to say at the beginning of the podcast that I didn't get to say because we are having technical difficulties in our apartment is that Gabe was a part of my first, like, must-listen-to podcast back in 2012, 2013, which was the Ace of Spades podcast. So having him on today was just a dream, and I loved, like, getting to ask him to come on today. So anybody listening, like, follow Gabriel Maller, and he's just been part of my entire existence on Twitter. It started there, and I don't know what else to say. So anyways, I had to fangirl a little bit.
It's true. I'm pretty great.
Yeah. No, I mean, for 3 years or better, the Ace of Spades podcast with you at the helm was always my, like, even to the point of Jay Crusoe, you know, thinking about quitting doing podcasting because your podcast was not up to par in my mind for, you know, the best or whatever. So I have to say that this has been one of the things that I've listened to and wanted to have happen. And so when Jay brought up, could you ask Gabriel Maller if he would come on and talk a bit to us? I was like, oh, I would love to do that. So anyways,
with stars in her eyes.
Yes, exactly. With stars in my eyes.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. Ben and Jay are old hands at what we used to call the blogosphere. And I feel like I was kind of old at that too. Things have changed so much, but it's kind of nice to see, like, the old faces, you know?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
And they're all getting very old.
We're all getting very old.
We're all getting very old.
So for you three, Even though Gabe is my age and you two are much older than us.
Well, I'm not that much older.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. The Seinfeld Experience sets a real and spectacular opening for this fall in New York. So they are going to have fans still tending the flame for Seinfeld, Jay Caruso, whose fabled NBC run began 30 years ago next month, will have a place in New York where they are, where they will have a hand, the Seinfeld Experience, part retail shop and part immersive show promotion. The ticketed attraction in the city's Gramercy neighborhood will operate 7 days a week. Tickets through February 2020 will go on sale in the coming months, according to Superfly and Warner Brothers Consumer Products.
So it's literally like an attraction where you do nothing?
Yes, oh, it's absolutely for Jay Caruso and family,
yeah, you know, as much as I love Seinfeld, I'm not sure I would want to do it. It's like, oh, it's a shopping experience, but I have to pay to get in. Yeah. And so I can see what, like a version of the apartment and kind of like.
Exactly.
Yeah. And since it's New York, it's probably going to cost like $45 to get into that place, too.
Right. And you get to see every single person that thinks they do the best Kramer entrance impersonation.
Oh, my gosh.
And
100
people saying, hello, Newman.
Yeah. I'll just watch repeats of the show on Hulu.
Yeah, to be clear, the actors were what I liked.
You know, Jay's best impersonation still is Neil Dewey. He just...
What does he do, wear a scarf?
Oh, gosh. You know, Ben, that's really not that funny.
That was a good callback.
I don't know. Gabe, do you like Seinfeld? Are you a Seinfeld fan or no?
Sure.
Okay. Sure.
It's because of his vast difference in age that Andrea was referencing. He was 10 years old when Seinfeld came out.
As was I.
Jay was 57. No.
All right. So that's going to do it for this episode. Gabe, thanks again for being on. Where can people find you?
Best way to find me is at Gabriel Maller on Twitter. And don't bomb my mentions because I'll mute you.
Don't bomb his mentions and be careful. If he's not having a good day and he asks a question, he may call you sweetheart and you just have to deal with it. I mean, that's just kind of it's all right. It was funny. I think this might have been during your contentious time. So I think if it was probably, you know, it was.
I like that you named it like it's the Jurassic period.
Well, you know, I'm saying his contentious time. You know, he changed the way he started using Twitter, as have I. I don't think, Ben, I think you're probably still doing it the old way because you just love all the attention.
Yeah, I love getting hated on all day. It's great.
Yeah, you do.
They got banned from Twitter for a week with his stint at the Dallas Morning News. Like, he had to relearn how to use Twitter for those.
Yeah, but that was like super restrictive. I was there. I called somebody stupid, and they were like, okay, you need to take a week off from Twitter. I was like, what? Yeah.
Wow.
The Washington Examiner doesn't have those things.
So basically, your free speech was suppressed.
I know, it was.
You need to get Congress involved.
It was, and since the Dallas Morning News is either, you know, is a complete left-wing outlet, I was discriminated against. I should
get
Kurt.
And since you have a constitutional right to work there.
I'm going to get Kurt to sue them. All right, Ben, where can everyone find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Ben Howe, not being followed by Gabriel Maller. And you can check out my
so special that Gabe Maller has, you know, it's like that.
Honestly, anybody who knows me in real life that unfollows me, I want to reply to them and just go, I get it.
I saw I get that.
It. Like, I understand.
I get retweeted by Gabe because Gabe follows Andrew, who retweets me. So there you go.
Right. That's why. Yeah. No. I mean, if I saw me on Twitter, I would block me. It's a fair point.
Right.
But and my book's coming out August 13th, The Immoral Majority. You can go to my Twitter, and you will see the link there.
Andrea.
At Andrea and Ruth, and I'm sorry, but like, you will never make me not defend Gabe Maller for any of his unfollows or not. Because he's been,
by the way, I just so you know, I've been to Jay and Andrea's house, and there's actually a poster of Gabriel above the bed, like on the ceiling, right next to New Kids on the Block.